And you're listening to 88.7 WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, broadcasting live from the campus Loyola University. And this is your bi-monthly dose of politics and policy with Jake Briscovich Briskman here on the Logic Consortium. And today on the line, we have Professor Lance Grievely. Professor, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And of course, you're a professor of anthropology at the University of Florida, and you're calling in right now from Florida, is that correct?
That's right. I'm here in Gainesville.
And first of all, before we get into your fantastic article, which will be the subject of today's discussion, How Race Becomes Biology, Embodiment of Social Inequality, I kind of want to just sketch out for our listeners a little bit about the field of anthropology. What anthropologists study, the different branches, what areas you have focused on, where do your studies fit in? So could we start off with something like a little bit of background for our listeners?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good place to start. One of my favorite pastimes is collecting people's reactions when they find out I'm an anthropologist, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about what it is. And I would say that anthropology is among the broadest of all disciplines because it's the study of humankind. It's the study of what it is to be human, and that includes our human cultural diversity as well as our human biological diversity. And anthropology at its best also looks at the intersection of those things, how culture and biology intersect and interact. There are four major branches of American anthropology. And those include cultural anthropology, biological anthropology, linguistic anthropology, and archaeology. And a lot of work cuts across those subfields, including the kind of work that I do in a field known as medical anthropology, where anthropologists study health and healing in a cross-cultural and an evolutionary perspective. And so that's sort of where I situate myself within the discipline.
So tell us a little bit about medical anthropology.
Well, it's among the fastest growing segments of anthropology. The Society for Medical Anthropology is one of the largest subsections of the American Anthropological Association, and it encompasses both the study of healing practices in cross-cultural perspective as well as the study of how society and culture influence our health, and including how the way that we live impacts our biology, our risk of disease. And this is also the piece of medical anthropology that's related to our discussion tonight, because it includes the study of the social patterning of disease. And so it's a rich and vibrant and exciting field.
So it's how society and culture influences our health. Please tell us a little bit about that.
That's a key piece of it. Well, it's a broad-ranging aspect of the field, and anthropologists work on those kinds of problems in a global perspective. So anthropologists study how culture change impacts health, looking at societies that are transitioning from pre-industrial subsistence strategies, hunter-gatherers, foraging, farming societies, as they transition into being integrated into the global economy, what are the health consequences of that kind of transition? Other anthropologists, medical anthropologists, study the health consequences of migration or transnationalism, how moving from one society to the next or having ties in multiple societies also impacts health, and that can be through differential access to healthcare. It can be through differential exposure to stressful circumstances. And really, the entire thrust of this work runs counter to the dominant narrative that we often hear when we talk about health. We often, at least in this society, talk about health in terms of individual behavior or individual access to healthcare. And what medical anthropology and related disciplines teach us is that really health is also socially distributed and it's socially patterned, and that if we want to understand population health, if we want to understand social inequalities in health, then we have to think not just about what people do as individuals, whether they diet and exercise, for example, or go to see their doctor. We also have to think about where they live and how they live and with whom they interact, because all of those aspects of social context also impact our health.
And that is, of course, a central tenet of your paper that I really want to get into. But before, in terms of health and anthropology and people's health and its juxtaposition with their race, which is the subject of kind of tonight's discussion, I kind of wanted to give a little bit of a historical timeline. It's something that you mentioned in your paper, is that in the 19th and 20th centuries, early 20th century, anthropologists were central in legitimating race as a framework for understanding human biological variation. But by the mid-20th century, most anthropologists have rejected race as biology, and the view of race as a cultural construct came to dominate the social sciences. Can you kind of lay out this historic, please give us like a little bit of a dichotomy of these two views and kind of lay out the history and how it's related to your studies?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, because that context is really key to understanding where we are now and how we think about race. Part of the unfortunate history of anthropology is that our forebears did play a key role in developing the very idea of race and in legitimating it as a way of trying to understand human difference. And this was really the main thrust of what the earliest anthropologists in the 19th and early 20th centuries were about. And that began to turn with the founding figure of American anthropology, Franz Boas, who was born in Germany, received a PhD in Germany, not in anthropology, but in physics, but then came to the United States and founded what we now think of as American-style anthropology with those four major subfields that I talked about. And one of Boas's lasting contributions was really to turn the tide against biological determinism, to turn the tide against the idea that we are fated to be what we inherit, and that that differences that we observe among populations are natural products of heredity. That was the prevailing idea at the turn of the 20th century when Boas was working. And he dedicated a lot of his work not just to political advocacy against that idea of race, but also he devoted his energy to putting it to the test. And in Boas's day, one of the key ideas was the so-called cephalic index. And this is a way of measuring the ratio of head length to head breadth. It doesn't sound all that interesting to us today, but 100 years ago, it was a central marker that some anthropologists and other scientists used as a marker of racial ancestry. And those early anthropologists read a lot into the cephalic index as a way of constructing whole theories of how societies evolved. And Boas rejected this idea, but he put it to the test. And he undertook this really Herculean study in the first decade of the 20th century, where he and his students and associates collected data on about 18,000 immigrants to New York, and as well as their children who were born in the United States. And he showed that within the span of a single generation, this aspect of head shape that was thought to be a fixed marker of race actually was susceptible to environmental influence, that the kids who were born in the United States had slightly differently shaped heads than did their parents. And this was the first real demonstration in any large scale of how human biology responds to our environment in very short time spans. Here we're talking about just one generation. And many of his students then picked up this charge, and by the middle of the 20th century, anthropologists were central in rejecting race as a legitimate way of describing human biological differences. And so by the middle of the 20th century, then the idea was dominant in anthropology and in other social sciences and in population genetics that race doesn't work as biology, that we should understand it instead as a product of political, economic circumstances that have played out since in the last 500 years of European expansion and colonialism and conquest. And so for the latter part of the 20th century, then, this idea of race as a social phenomenon really took hold. Now, the unfortunate side effect of this, in my view, is that anthropologists, at least, found it increasingly difficult to talk about the relationship between race and biology, and for good reasons, because it was tied up in the history of eugenics and a lot of scientific racism. But the blind spot that emerged is that for a long while we didn't really grasp how racial inequalities in those very political and economic circumstances that gave rise to the idea of race in the first place, how those fundamentally social facts could impact our biology. They could actually produce differences in biology because of differential exposure to toxic environments and to harmful circumstances. And so part of what's happening now, and I situate my own work in this movement, but there are many other scholars, not just in anthropology, but in social epidemiology, sociology, public health, who are also working to understand how social inequalities that are linked to race and embedded in systemic racism actually have health consequences.
And, I mean, this, with Boas, the idea of plasticities, I think I kind of drew that from your article, came to the forefront. And also this idea of embodiment, somebody embodying their kind of surroundings. Can you talk about those two things and how kind of the reflective of Boas's sea change that he brought?
Sure. Let's talk about plasticity first. And, you know, I think this is an important point to recognize, because so often when anthropologists think about Boas, or when our colleagues and other social scientists think about Boas, we think about his contributions in cultural anthropology or in linguistic anthropology, his work in the Pacific Northwest, for example. But he also was hugely important in our understanding of human biology. And one of the key contributions was really identifying this concept of plasticity. And this refers to the way that the development of phenotypes, of the observable, measurable aspects of our biology, emerge and respond based on the environmental exposures that we have. And this concept of plasticity had developed in biology before Boas and had been applied to many other organisms, but hadn't really been developed in the study of human biology. And Boas's immigrant study really opened up that possibility. And some of Boas's students took it up and replicated the same kind of design with other migrant populations and also demonstrated plasticity in head form. And, you know, looking back at it now, plasticity in head form doesn't sound all that revolutionary to us. But if we look back and we think about the historical context in which Boas was working, you know, this idea of plasticity wasn't part of how people were viewing human biology. It was viewing human biology through that racial lens, assumed that head shape, like other aspects of human nature, were fixed, and they were fixed by your racial ancestry. So opening up the study of plasticity really changed all that. And as you follow that out, then over the 20th century, an important branch of anthropology is within biological anthropology, study of human biology, that is biological adaptability and variation in contemporary living populations. So that's always been an important part of what anthropologists do. And there in Chicago, perhaps some of your listeners know, there are quite a number of really excellent anthropologists who work at universities there around Chicago in that area as well. Now, the concept of embodiment that you mentioned and that I write about, the way that I'm using the term embodiment I'm drawing on the work of a social epidemiologist named Nancy Krieger. And her notion of embodiment is embedded in a broader theory that she has about how social conditions impact population health and drive health inequalities. And the core of the idea is that how the circumstances under which we live, work, and play actually impacts how our bodies develop and impacts how our biology works. So as opposed to the old 19th and earlier century idea that our biology is fixed and it's rooted in only in what we inherit from our ancestry, both the concepts of plasticity and embodiment say, no, we need to understand the conditions under which we develop and we grow, and because that has a lasting impact on how our bodies work.
So through all of this, anthropologists developed kind of the mantra that race is not biology. Can you kind of talk about how that was has been the takeaway from Boas's movement and how that's become kind of a central tenet of thinking in anthropology? But as you point out in the paper, it hasn't really seeped into the public understanding of race.
Yeah, this is an unfortunate history. It's a case where anthropologists may have won the battle but lost the war. The idea that race is not biology is correct in spirit, but we have to be clear about what that actually means. What it means is that the race concept is not a good way of describing the true patterns of human biological variation. And actually, usually, even more specifically, what we mean is that the race concept is not a good way of describing human genetic variation. When we look at our species all around the world, we see that the true patterning is much more complex than the race concept allows. And that some of the assumptions built into race, the idea that there are discrete groups that are relatively homogenous, each of them on their own, that there are clear boundaries, that certain traits get bundled together, those ideas don't hold up. And we know from decades now of genetic and other biological research that it doesn't work the way the race concept assumes. And so that part of the critique that race is not biology is right. But the trouble is that too often people hear anthropologists and other social scientists say race is not biology, and they think what we mean is that we're all alike. And this defies common sense to the extent that we look around and we see clear signs of variation all around us. And they're often variation in relatively superficial traits that themselves are racially marked. But this makes it difficult for people to process this idea that race is not biology. And so we have to clarify that what we're saying is not that there is no variation. We're not saying that all humans are alike, although we're a less variable species than any of our closest relatives. We're saying that, yes, there is variation, but it's not patterned in the way that the race concept assumes, and that we actually obscure our understanding of how humans vary from one another in a genetic sense if we impose the prism of race. And I would say that there's actually a further problem, and the further problem is about the conflation of biology and genetics, because when anthropologists and other social scientists say race is not biology, as I say, what they really mean is race is not a good way of describing human genetic variation. But there's this kind of sinister thing that happens in that formulation, because notice that we collapse that nuanced argument about genetic variation into this slogan of race is not biology. And when we do that, we sort of reinforce this reductionist way of thinking about biology that reduces it down to genes. So the other part of the critique that gets lost when we simply say race is not biology is that biology is also not just genetics, and that we, you know, most of us learned back in high school that phenotype is the product of genotype and environment. And if that's the case, then that means environment is just as much a part of biology as the genotype is. And yet the way science proceeds, and especially the way a lot of media coverage of science and medical science in particular plays out, we lose that very old idea that many of us learned in high school. We lose the environment. And so we need to remind ourselves that if we want to understand biology, then we need to understand not just the genotype, we need to understand the environment as well. And that's a nuance that I think also gets lost when we collapse this idea down to race is not biology.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the most revelatory parts of your paper for me, a non-anthropologist, really kind of distinguishing and delineating the boundaries of biology and genetics. Can you kind of, because that's a very important part of the paper for me at least.
I'm really glad that came across. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. You know, can you kind of lay that out for our listeners? Biology is not genetics, and how that plays into your paper and your work?
Yeah, I'll do my best. And let me try to approach that with an example. And it's an example that I think also illustrates exactly what's at stake here. Every so often we see some report in the media about an important discovery in the medical sciences that has to do with race and health. And one example that comes to mind is a paper from a few years ago that was featured on the front page of the Science Times section of the New York Times. And this story ran with a picture of an African-American infant in a hospital. And the headline over it said, "Study points to genetics in racial disparities in preterm birth," or something to that effect. At any rate, both the headline and the newspaper report itself gave the impression that researchers had just identified some genes that were responsible for the disproportionate burden of preterm delivery among African-American women in the U.S. Nationwide, preterm birth is about twice as common among African-American women as it is among European-American women. And it's not just that the headline and the newspaper report gave this idea that there was some new genetic evidence. If you actually went and read the scientific article on which this report was based, which was published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, then the authors of that paper also were very clear that they were arguing for a genetic basis to racial inequalities in preterm birth. And not only that, but that paper was actually featured as the editor's choice in that month of American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and it was published along with the comments of four other doctors and an epidemiologist who agreed that the genetic link was very strong and that this paper was really evidence of that. And here's the problem. The problem is that study actually included no genetic data. They didn't collect any genetic data whatsoever. There was no analysis of DNA. There was no identification of any genes that were differentially distributed between black and white moms or linked to preterm birth. Instead, what had happened was the researchers observed there was this twofold greater risk among black moms. They measured the usual suspects, education, smoking and tobacco use, a handful of other health behavior and social status variables. And they found that even after accounting for those variables, there was still a greater risk of preterm birth for black moms as compared to white moms. And they looked at that biological difference of preterm birth And they concluded that, therefore, it must be genetic. Now, of course, this is not sound reasoning, because there are any number of unmeasured factors that could have accounted for that difference. They measured, as I say, a handful of health behavior and social environmental variables, but they sure didn't measure everything that we could have measured. They didn't measure anything related to the stresses of being Black in a racially stratified society, for example. And where this is so key is that we too often go from the mere observation of some difference in phenotype, some biological outcome like preterm birth or low birth weight, or hypertension, high blood pressure, or certain kinds of cancers or diabetes. We see that those biological differences exist. And it's too easy for many people to say, well, those biological differences must be due to genes. And then the norms of science, where we usually demand evidence, those norms often, too often, get suspended. And cases like this one that I'm talking about pass through peer review and get promoted with press releases from the journals and picked up by the New York Times to perpetuate this idea. And it's a flawed idea that that race corresponds to some fundamental genetic differences that shapes our health. And if you really pay attention to some of the media coverage, or even if you read the scientific literature, the medical journals and discussion about race, or for that matter, even if you read the anthropologist's own critiques of race, I'm sorry to say, you too often see this elision of biology and genetics, that we use the terms almost interchangeably. And when we do that, then we actually reinforce the reductionism and the essentialism that got us into trouble in the first place. We reinforce this notion that our biology is a product of our genes alone, without thinking carefully and really taking seriously the environment, including how our environment is shaped in this country by systemic racism.
And you talk about how, and this goes right to what you're talking about, the challenge is to describe the different ways that race becomes biology. And some great illustrative examples that you give are one that you, I believe was your study about, I believe it was high blood pressure and skin color. And
yes.
And then also, if you could talk about that, and also a very interesting example is women after 9/11 with Arabic-sounding last names and how that affected, I believe, infant mortality rate or birth weights. Can you kind of talk about those in the context of what you were talking about how genes and biology is not genetics?
Sure. Let me pick it up with the first example that you mentioned, which is from my own work on skin color and blood pressure. So the context for this is that we know that African Americans, and also people of African descent elsewhere in the Americas, in the Caribbean and in Latin America, tend to have higher rates of hypertension, which is chronic high blood pressure, and higher average blood pressures than do other people in the same societies. And in fact, here in the U.S., that difference in hypertension is the single most important contributor to Black-white inequalities in life expectancy. So it's from a public health perspective, it's a critical problem. There's a further piece of the puzzle here, which is that within populations of African descent in the Americas, darker-skinned individuals tend to have higher blood pressures on average than do their lighter-skinned counterparts. So in the U.S., darker-skinned African Americans have been shown to have higher blood pressures on average than lighter-skinned African Americans. And similar patterns, though smaller in magnitude, have been seen in various parts of the Caribbean and Latin America as well. And when those studies were first published, the first study on skin color and blood pressure was published in one of the most prestigious medical journals there is, the Journal of the American Medical Association, back in 1970. And the author there, Dr. Boyle, explained that he was using skin color as a proxy for genetic ancestry. The terminology was a little different in 1970, but that's more or less what he was saying, is that he was measuring skin color or skin pigmentation as a proxy for racial ancestry. And so that pattern, higher blood pressure with darker skin, was interpreted then as evidence of some racial genetic predisposition to high blood pressure, that there were some as yet unknown genes associated with African ancestry that were linked to both darker skin color and higher blood pressure. But within a few years, the critique emerged. Sherman James and Herman Teroler published a paper in which they outlined a different hypothesis. And that hypothesis was based on the insight that skin color is not just a biological variable, it's also a marker of social status in color-conscious societies like the U.S. and in Latin America, where this pattern had been observed. And so they proposed that what could be going on here is that darker-skinned African-Americans and darker-skinned people of African descent elsewhere in the Americas may have higher blood pressure because they are more likely to experience the social conditions that produce stressful lives and that result in sustained high blood pressure. And so over the next couple of decades, there were a series of studies that looked at this question one way or the other, but the basic problem was that that fundamental distinction between skin color as a biological variable or as a sociocultural fact, that distinction didn't get really drawn out. And so that was really the objective of my work in Puerto Rico. I went to Puerto Rico because it's a place where people think differently about skin color than here in the U.S. As a rule. And it was a place where it was possible to imagine that two people could have the same skin pigmentation, the same skin tone, and yet be classified by others into different social categories. One might be negro and the other might be pirigueño, another might be indio, for example. And so we set about then in Puerto Rico to test this idea. And the bottom line is that we did produce evidence that how people see themselves and how they are seen by others in terms of culturally meaningful ways of thinking about color, those ways of classifying self and other were associated with blood pressure. But objective measurements of skin pigmentation, the actual amount of pigment in the skin, the amount of light reflected by the skin, that was not associated with blood pressure. And we went on from there to look at DNA-based measures of genetic ancestry, and we replicated the finding there as well, working together with my colleagues, Connie Mulligan and Amy Nahn. We showed that, again, these social categories of color associated with blood pressure, but genetic ancestry was not. And, you know, I think that this, if you're still hanging with me in this.
Of course.
I think that, you know, I get excited about this example and thinking back to where our conversation started about the origins of American anthropology, Franz Boas's rejection of biological determinism, because I often think that if Boas were around now rather than 100 years ago when he was working, that these are the issues he would be working on. He would be working on health inequalities, because skin color and is really like the cephalic index of our day. I mean, we look back now on cephalic index, this measurement of head shape, doesn't seem interesting, and it's hard to understand how anyone could have made such a big deal about it. In some sense, it's a little bit puzzling that anybody would have thought to study the association between skin color and blood pressure, too, if you think about it. I mean, could that question have appeared anywhere except in a society where we think that skin color is a fundamental, yields some fundamental insight into our deep-rooted biology? So the very framing of the question itself exposes how deeply embedded racial thinking is in our society and the way it shapes the way science gets done. And, you know, Boaz's approach to the cephalic index was to say, okay, you think the cephalic index is a marker of racial ancestry. Let's put it to the test. And he designed this famous study from 100 years ago. And I think that the work on skin color and blood pressure that I've done is very much in the Boasian tradition. It's nowhere near as significant in the history of science or anthropology, but I see that work as part of Boas's legacy of saying, okay, let's take this critique of race and let's take some of the assumptions about skin color and race and let's put them to the test. And when we do that, so far, when we put those ideas head to head, when we say, all right, there's a genetic hypothesis for skin color and blood pressure, and there's a sociocultural hypothesis for the relation between skin color and blood pressure. When we put those things head to head, it's clear that the sociocultural hypothesis does a much better job of explaining who develops high blood pressure and why. And still to this day, we don't have any convincing genetic evidence that high blood pressure in African Americans is because of genetic factors, but we have a lot of evidence accumulating that the social conditions associated with systemic racism expose people to environments that harm health, including things like elevated blood pressure. You asked me about another study. Did you want to follow up on anything about skin color before
yes.
I pressed on?
Yes, and let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Professor Lance Gravely, professor of anthropology at the University of Florida, really talking about the ideas that have come up in a recent, well, it's not so recent, your article, I believe about 5 years ago, but I guess it made an enormous impact in the field of anthropology because a friend of mine who's an anthropologist mentioned it to me that this is the first thing I should be reading. And the article is, of course, entitled How Race Becomes Biology, Embodiment of Social Inequality. Professor, one thing that I was super interested in what you just said is your study in Puerto Rico and talking about how Puerto Ricans think about skin color differently. Can you kind of give us your observations and your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of decades worth of research by social scientists working not just in Puerto Rico, but other places in Latin America, where a very different kind of a process of racialization has played out. And, you know, when I showed up in Puerto Rico in 2000 as a graduate student to begin my research there, I sort of went in naively, like a lot of other North American social scientists had, I guess, talking about race and asking questions about race. And, you know, a woman who later became a friend and a really important consultant in my work explained to me that I was asking all the wrong questions, that it wasn't about race. And if I kept talking about race, people weren't going to understand. But she said, you know, she explained to me the simple idea that that probably many of your listeners already take for granted, that on the island, when people talk about race, they would speak about la raza puertorriqueña, it's a sense of nationality, a sense of nationhood. And that that idea of race, in some sense, means the exact opposite of what the concept of race in the United States means. Because race in the United States often connotes homogeneity and purity within these groups, that there are these distinct groups that themselves are very like one another, distinct from others. And there's a very different way of thinking in Puerto Rico and in many other parts of Latin America, where the notion of of la raza puertorriqueña is a notion of mixture, of what makes Puerto Ricanness is this integration of Spanish and Taino and African roots, usually in that order, by the way. And so I went on to learn that what really mattered was a different kind of hierarchy that's often expressed in terms of skin color. It's often expressed in terms of color. But also the idea of color is not just about skin color, because it also entails differences, ideas about hair and about facial features and even body shape and so forth. And why all of this mattered for understanding health is, as I say, it raised the possibility that two people who might have the same skin tone and who in the United States might both be considered black, in Puerto Rico, those people could be placed into different categories depending on other features, depending on their hair, depending on their facial features, depending on other aspects of social status, what part of town they live in, what kind of jobs they had, where their family came from, and so forth. And this idea was evident in the results, where we saw that when we actually measured people's skin color, there were certain ranges of skin color where people could be placed into different categories. And that's what made it possible for us to say, okay, well, so which one actually predicts blood pressure better? Is it the skin tone, or is it the category that they're placed into, this sort of social category? And that's where it came clear that it was really the social categories that mattered, that skin color itself wasn't the answer. It was really about the meaning that we attribute to skin color in a society that is structured according to these racial hierarchies.
And that segues us nice into this idea that has been kind of repeated, become a central idea in anthropology, that race is a cultural construct. And then you talk about how that needs to be a starting point for different avenues of research in your article. And how that anthropologists really need to kind of refine some of the central tenets. So first of all, can you talk about this idea of race as a, you know, anthropologists saying that race is a cultural construct, and kind of segue us into your article and your call for different research and what is behind your call and what you think it can accomplish?
Yeah, I think that the core problem is that when anthropologists and other social scientists say that race is a cultural construct, too often in anthropology, that's been the end of the story. And where this really breaks down is that anthropologists have often invoked the idea that race is a cultural construct as a way to reject racial genetic determinism. But there's a very clear mismatch there. If the argument is that race doesn't work as a way of describing human genetic variation, then really the only way to substantiate that argument is with genetic data. In some sense, it doesn't matter that race is culturally constructed, because in fact, all claims about the world are culturally constructed. Every scientific statement is culturally constructed to the extent that it emerges from the human mind and from a social process that we call science. So the claim that the Earth revolves around the sun is also culturally constructed. That doesn't mean that it's false. And this is the problem with trying to combat racial genetic determinism by trumpeting the idea that race is a cultural construct. The more effective and really the only logical way to reject racial genetic determinism is to put it to the test. If there's a claim about some supposed genetic basis for racial inequalities in some health outcome, then we would need to have genetic evidence, genetic data to test that idea. And by and large, what's so dangerous is that these ideas about some genetic basis for racial differences in health. Those ideas circulate and do so in the absence of any genetic data, like the case I mentioned earlier from the New York Times. But it's not a singular case. This pattern happens all the time. So our energy needs to be devoted in part to putting those claims to the test, and also in recognizing, to cycle back to the earlier point, that human biology is sensitive to environmental exposures and experiences over the lifetime. So we need to pay attention to those experiences and environments because they are likely to have a huge impact in the first place. And they're also likely to be amenable to policy changes and to practical solutions that could ameliorate suffering and death. We aren't going to do anything about the genes, but we could do something about race-based residential segregation and disinvestment in urban neighborhoods and crime and poor infrastructure in schools and housing and on and on. The other element is this idea that when we say that race is a cultural construct, then that needs to be only the starting point. Then we should take it really as a call to action, as a mandate for research to understand exactly what does that mean to say that race is a cultural construct? How is it constructed? What social context does it emerge from? And in the context of this discussion, one of the questions we could be asking there is, how is the race concept introduced into scientific research, genetic research, medical research, clinical medicine? And there are a number of great people, scholars, who are working on these questions in anthropology, Juana Fulwiley and Michael Montoya and many others, Catherine Bliss and Linda Hunt. Lots of people are working on these questions, and that's really important. So the idea is that we need to move beyond the bumper sticker version of the critique, which is that race is not biology, it's a cultural construct, and we need to recognize that there's a lot more nuance required in both parts of that formulation, and that unfortunately, when we reduce the critique to that slogan, we sometimes unwittingly reinforce the ideas that got us into trouble in the first place, those ideas of genetic reductionism and genetic essentialism.
And to kind of finish up, so you talked about the research potentially leading to policy changes. Can you talk about that a little bit and maybe some hopes in that arena?
Sure. It's a complicated problem, of course, but there is some hope. You know, I mean, we can't have the discussion right now without talking about the very clear evidence of structural racism that's in the news now. It's all too clear that structural racism is alive and well in the United States. And so we could link this discussion about blood pressure to discussion about police brutality, racialized police brutality and other forms of oppression in the United States. I want to expand our thinking about what it means to do health policy and to intervene in health. Basically, any kind of policy change that improves people's lives is going to have health consequences. So addressing mass incarceration of African Americans, addressing the school-to-prison pipeline, reforming community policing, investing in education and in jobs and in housing. Any policy change that moves us closer towards social and economic equity is also going to have positive impacts on public health, and probably, frankly, much bigger impacts than any policy change that we talk about usually in the scope of health care. One of the sad realities is that we could fix everything that's wrong with healthcare in the United States, and racial inequalities in health would still exist. They would persist because what drives those inequalities is not really access to healthcare, although access to healthcare matters for sure. But the question is, why do people get sick in the first place? What brings them there in the first place? And those, the fundamental social and economic conditions that drive those inequalities is where our attention needs to be focused, not just on healthcare. Now, those are all very big problems that, frankly, I'm ill-equipped to address. But there are also things that we can do, you know, at local levels. I work with a tremendous community in Tallahassee, Florida, a couple hours away from here in Gainesville. And some of our community partners there, Ms. Maisha Mitchell and Dr. Ed Hollyfield and Dr. Kasima Boston and others, are doing amazing grassroots work there to make people's lives better. And a lot of that work there has revolved around food justice and the food environment. And so one of the ways that they're intervening in that community is supporting more urban farming and more community gardens and youth leadership development programs. And all of these things are making people's lives a little bit better. And they're local ways of building on strengths in the community to solve problems that, you know, as a social scientist, we can analyze as linked to structural racism, the disinvestment in their communities, the emergence of food deserts and so forth. And, you know, I draw a lot of hope and inspiration from seeing what those folks are doing on the ground and ways that they're transforming their own communities. I think that, you know, to really pursue this discussion, all of us need to take a lead from the people who know most about the consequences of systemic racism. And that's the people who suffer from it and who resist it and overcome it on a daily basis. And so really listening to the expertise that people have about their own lives is, I think, a way to move us forward towards some kinds of solutions.
Professor Lance Gravely, thank you so much for coming in on our program to talk about your article and the issues surrounding your article, How Race Becomes Biology, Embodiment of Social Inequality. Thank you, and keep up the great work.
Thanks so much for having me, Jake. I appreciate it.
Have a great night.
You too. Bye.
And that was our conversation with Professor Lance Gravely about his article, How Race Becomes Biology. We'll be back with you. We're not going to be here on the 28th, but we will be here on the second Sunday at 7 p.m. in January. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a great new year and talk to you soon.